Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the Old Testament, the story of the creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption and healing of all humankind. Our guest again today is Ron Eldred, teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Father Larry Moran, chaplain at the Carmelites just south of Terre Haute at the entrance of Allendale. We've been talking up to this time about the great King David, from whom the Messiah was to come. We spoke especially about the prophecy of Nathan to David, about that he would not, God did not want him to build a temple or a house for him, because God was going to build a house for David, or a kingdom, or a reign that would last forever. A new covenant, a entirely new relationship he wanted in his people. And this, of course, would be the preface to the Messiah coming into the world. So as great as King David was, we know that he got into lots of troubles, and we're going to be talking about that in our lesson today. So Ron, welcome once again. And maybe we can start that under King David, the Israelites created a large empire, biggest they ever had. Describe this a little for us, if you would.
The Israelites under David's leadership, they won many victories. And his empire stretched from the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers in Mesopotamia, which would be in modern-day Iraq, to the border of Egypt. Allegedly, one of the greatest empires of its day. Now, I've seen the number of programs on TV, on the documentary channels, where they've debated just exactly how big David's kingdom was, and some thought he was not much more than a tribal chief. Others thought he got to be a grand and big king, very similar to the kings, let's say, of Egypt, the pharaohs of Egypt, and the kings of Assyria at that time. But, well, nonetheless, as
at least
a result,
it was larger than they had ever had.
Yes. And keep in mind now that up to that time, they'd simply been 12 tribes that had spent a good part of their time in the desert wilderness. And then another 200 years scattered all over the place through the Promised Land, and not really having any real united front to any extent. Only during the Judges at times was there, as we discussed in one of our earlier sessions, was there any kind of united Israel. But as a result of this empire, David became very rich, famous, and powerful. But God was not pleased with his lust for territory and power. He had conquered lands that had never been part of God's promise to Abraham. And as one scholar has said, David regarding this matter, quote, "The temptations growing out of wealth and power began to work on him, and he gave in. Not satisfied with restoring Israel's rule of the promised land, he struck outward in quest of other lands to conquer. At one point, his empire reached all the way to the Euphrates River. By his conquest, David made Israel fully the equal of any power in the world of his time." And that ends that quote. And then, furthermore, David offended God by taking another man's wife and arranging for his death on the battlefield.
Certainly a tragic story about a fall of a good king to his own lusts. What about, it's one of the most famous stories in the Bible, Ron, about David and Bathsheba. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Well, it was during these conquests that one scholar has said that he fell in love with Bathsheba, the wife of a loyal soldier in his army, and he committed adultery with her. And then he ordered that her husband Uriah be placed at the head of his army in battle, so that he could be killed, or at least a high possibility that he could be killed. So, David violated three of the Ten Commandments enshrined within the Ark of the Covenant that he had just brought with such rejoicing into the city of Jerusalem. In fact, they set up the tabernacle in the city of Jerusalem and then put, of course, the Ark of the Covenant in it.
The presence of God for the Jewish people.
There's an interesting story about when the Ark was brought in, of David rejoicing and dancing in front of the Ark as it was brought into the city. And supposedly the story goes he was dancing naked.
Oh.
One of his wives got very, very upset with him over it, even to the point that, if I recall right, he repudiated her later.
Micaiah,
okay. Something of that sort. It was one of Saul's daughters.
Okay.
But David had seen Bathsheba from the roof of his palace while her husband was out in the field doing battle with Israel's enemy. And after impregnating her in an adulterous affair to cover up his sin, he ordered Uriah to come in from the battlefield to sleep with his wife. When Uriah did come in, but he refused to sleep with his wife.
Because he was still a soldier in battle.
Yeah, in other words, here all my men are out there fighting and this, that, and the other. I have no right to enjoy this kind of, you know, comfort and intimacy, you know, with my wife. So when Uriah returned to the battlefield, David ordered his general, Joab, to put him in the most dangerous part of the battle where he was killed. And afterwards, David took Bathsheba into his household as a wife.
So obviously, he had specifically planned the murder of Uriah, because he even told, I believe, in the incident, Joab to put him in the front line of battle, as you said, and then to draw back so that he would be killed.
Mm-hmm.
So murder by determination and previous plotting. Well, wasn't David severely punished for his sins, which were great?
Yes, he was. Although he repented of his sins, God severely punished him. We find this especially in 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. And to punish him, God afflicted his family with disorder and violence. His sons fought with each other and were disrespectful toward him as he got older. We find a lot of that in 2 Samuel chapters 13 through 16. And one of his sons, Amnon, raped his half-sister Tamar, and her brother Absalom killed him. And because David refused to do anything about it. So Absalom fled to Egypt for a while. But his father eventually let him return back to Jerusalem, but he didn't allow him to enter into his presence. David didn't. Absalom won the hearts of the people, and he rebelled against his father. And so then David was forced to go into exile beyond the Jordan River. And then to add insult to injury, Absalom, now who's ruling in Jerusalem, but actually he's not the legitimate ruler, he took his father's concubines into his harem. In other words, David had a harem, just like lots of kings did back in those days. Bathsheba was not his only wife, you know. It doesn't say in the Bible how many concubines that David had, but usually they had a fairly good number. So Absalom takes his father's kind of semi-wives, I guess you could say, concubines into his harem. It really was, you know, an insult, of course, to his father. And David was able to make a counterattack from there, from beyond the Jordan. And although he had ordered that Absalom not be killed in battle, General Joab, that is David's lead general, and his men killed him when they came across him hanging by a tree by his hair. I remember that story even as a young
kid. He went under the tree and his horse and his long hair was caught in the branches and he was hanging there.
Yeah, apparently he had long, beautiful hair or something like that, and it caught in the branches.
And they ran him through, and he was hanging there from the tree by his hair.
As I said, I remember that story very, vividly from Bible stories when
right.
I was a kid. Although David's army won the battle, David wept bitterly when he heard that his beloved son Absalom had been killed. And he uttered one of the most famous cries of the Old Testament when he said, quote, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I have died instead of you, O Absalom, my son. We find that, of course, in 2 Samuel 18. Well, David, he continued to love his son, even though he had rebelled against him and he tried to kill him, even taking his concubines. But that was just punishment, you know, for David's sins. All in all, David lost four of his sons as punishment for his sins. And after David regained his throne, the union between the north and the south of his kingdom was very fragile at best. Moreover, he showed his bad side by refusing to take his concubines back into his household, condemning them to a life of solitude. In a lot of ways, David isn't a very likable person. He had a lot of blood on his hands. And having had the seven, for example, I don't know if we mentioned this earlier session or not, but when he first became king, he had seven sons of Saul executed. And, of course, this is the murder of Uriah added to that. So he had plenty of blood on his hands.
Okay. Well, when David was old and feeble, Bathsheba connived to get him to designate their son Solomon as king. That's, of course, he becomes one of the great kings of Israel. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, due to this connivance, David abdicated in favor of his son Solomon in order to prevent another son, Adonijah, from seizing the throne from him. And actually, Adonijah was the rightful heir to the throne because he was the eldest after Absalom. But once in power, David had Adonijah and others who had rebelled killed. And since General Joab had supported Adonijah, he too was killed. He'd been David's top general. And he clung to the tabernacle. Adonijah was clinging to the tabernacle when he was killed. I'll conclude this discussion of David by quoting from Ann Carroll's book, Christ the King, Lord of History. We use that book in our world history class at John Paul II Catholic High School, where I teach. She says, David had gone from unknown shepherd boy to the greatest king in the world so long as he was faithful to God. But when he used his power to do evil, he saw his world crumble. Yet God had still another lesson to teach, that he can use weak and even sinful men to accomplish his aims. Thus David's sins did not wipe out the prophecy that one of David's descendants would be the king who would save not only Israel, but all of mankind.
Okay, say just a word. We were talking about it before our program. Martian was a priest who wanted to get rid of the whole Old Testament. And sometimes when I read through these things that we're talking about, I can see why he would get very discouraged about the lack of dedication and fidelity to the Jewish people, and particularly the kings. You want to say a word about Martian?
Well, this was in late 1st on into the 2nd century, and there were, sometimes they were actually Christians, sometimes they were pagans who were critical of the Old Testament, the Jews in the Old Testament, and partly at least in part because of all the conniving and the sinning taking place, the battles, a lot of times in battles, even during the time of Joshua, they would wipe out all the men, women, and children that they'd conquered in some region, and various things like that. And the lives of David and Solomon and all the bad kings that followed that, there's about 40 bad kings, for the most part, that follow Solomon, David. And so Marcion, he rejected the Old Testament. What he did, he not only rejected the Old Testament, but he actually rejected a lot of the New Testament, because Luke is the only book he actually accepted, and he only accepted 10 books of Luke. And the reason he only accepted 10 books of Luke...
Now, you mean 10 chapters?
10 chapters.
Okay.
The reason he did that is because Luke was writing to the Gentiles, who were basically pagans, you know, and they're trying to convert them to Christianity. Matthew and Mark and certainly John was more akin to the Jewish way of looking at things to some extent, so that's one of the reasons he left them out and selected Luke. And he left out those parts of Luke where he talked about the Messiah coming, you know, from the Jewish people and all that kind of thing. He also included 10 of Paul's letters. And the reason he included 10 of Paul's letters was because Paul was the apostle to the Gentiles. And as we discussed a couple of sessions ago, Paul, you know, said something to the effect that Christians were not under the law. And we spent a whole session talking about that, so we won't reiterate that right now. Which really meant that they didn't have to practice the purification rites and the sabbatical laws and the other 613 mitzvot or whatever.
So Marcion really was anti-Jewish.
And one of the reasons was because of all these stories. You
terrible
know,
that, things that the
terrible
kings
things
did.
That you find in the Old Testament, yes.
Well, I can see sometimes why we'd be upset about the very things we're saving. Before we leave King David, anything you'd like to say about before we go on to King Solomon, his sons taking over the kingdom and the chair?
Well, I think just a few words about Jerusalem before we go on, because this is going to play such a pivotal role all the way through the rest of the story. The Jerusalem of Jesus' time did not look anything like the city that David conquered in the 10th century B.C. From the time of the conquest, Jerusalem was known as the city of David or Zion, Mount Zion. It is identified with Salem, Melchizedek's capital. We talked about that story much earlier in a much earlier session, found in Genesis 14. And Melchizedek was the king and priest of Salem at the time of Abraham. And after a great victory in battle over his enemies, he offered a sacrifice of thanksgiving. And he blessed Abraham, who gave him tithes of all that he had taken in his own battles. It was prophesied that the priesthood of the coming Messiah would be of the order of Melchizedek. We find that, of course, in Psalms 110. St. Paul developed the figure of Melchizedek into a type of Christ figure, the eternal high priest of the new covenant. That story is found in Hebrews 7.
Okay, now the location of Jerusalem is still the same.
Yes, it was located about 32 miles east of the Mediterranean and 13 miles west of the Dead Sea. And it's still situated, it was situated on large hills surrounded by valleys, making it easily defensible. Mount Scopus and the Mount of Olives were among the hills surrounding the city. Well, the city itself was built on Mount Zion and Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah is where Abraham was asked to sacrifice Isaac.
Okay.
And that's where the temple was built. King Solomon built the temple on Mount Moriah. I always tell my students when we're talking about this, Jerusalem is a very hilly city, big valley, right, goes right north and south, right through the middle of Tyropoeian Valley, I think it's called, and then to the east, the eastern wall is the Kidron Valley, and on the south is the Valley of Hinnon, and then there's a valley on the north side, I can't recall the name of that right now. It sort of reminds me a little bit. I've been in San Francisco several times, very hilly in this the city is. I've never been to Jerusalem, but I have a feeling it's probably similar to that. They say Rome is built on a lot of hills, too, a very hilly city. Well, the population was very small at first, but had grown to around 200 to 250,000 at the time of Jesus' life on earth, which was about 1,000 years after the time of King David. During the festivals, such as the Passover, the city's population swelled to well over a million. And many peoples have ruled the city over the centuries, including the Egyptians, Assyrians, Persians, Greeks, Romans, Arabs, Crusaders, Turks, and then finally Great Britain, before it was in 1948 made into the modern state of Israel. In fact, Great Britain turned the country over to Israeli forces in 1967, and it is the holy city of Christians, Jews, and Muslims alike.
So the three great monotheistic religions who recognize one God.
Yes, all three religions recognize the the city as a you know, a sacred place. It actually, these three religions are the religion of the book, as the Muslims will call them. In other words, the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims.
Okay, Ron, we discussed in our series Understanding the Bible, a Catholic approach to interpreting sacred scripture, that the city of Jerusalem can be considered in several senses of scripture. Can we comment on how Jerusalem has been through history looked on in interpreting as people read the Bible about Jerusalem?
Well, without going into detail, the Catholic Bible scholars, scripture scholars, and theologians have found four biblical senses or uses of the city of Jerusalem. You might recall earlier in this series, and then in another series, we talked about the literal sense of scripture, and then we talked about the spiritual sense of scripture. The literal is simply what the words say, and of course that's significant.
But
sometimes there's a deeper underlying meaning, and St. Augustine and Origen and people of that sort began to develop the idea that there was a deeper spiritual meaning. And this is basically called typology, that there are persons, places, situations, circumstances, events, and things of that sort in the Old Testament that foreshadow or prefigure or hint at greater things to happen in the New Testament. For example, there are lots of figures of Christ in the Old Testament. I think we named about a dozen of them or so earlier in an earlier session.
Jonah and the whale, 3 days, and coming forth alive.
Moses and Isaac and many others. Well, so the literal sense that it is a real city in Judea, and lots of historical events happened in that city described in the Old Testament. They were meant to be taken literally. But then there's the allegorical sense, which means a symbol of the Old Testament or covenant made by God with mankind before the coming of Christ on earth, and also an image of the Catholic Church, that is, Jerusalem being an image of the Catholic Church. Heaven brought to earth, the heavenly city, or the New Jerusalem of the New Testament or covenant. And then finally, there's the moral sense, which means an image of the soul, that Jerusalem is an image of the soul. So those are at least, and actually there's one more, the anagogical sense, which means it's our heavenly destiny, you know, the new Jerusalem. That's I think the book of Revelation, if I recall right, talks about this new heaven and a new earth and the new Jerusalem and that kind
of thing. It's a way of imagining with a picture that people know about the city of Jerusalem. And it's a way of imagining, like, the green pastures of paradise, the great jewel city, the new Jerusalem in heaven and the like. Okay, well, we've come to perhaps the greatest of the Jewish kings who started out wonderfully, King Solomon, the son of King David, who was commissioned by God to build the temple. So let's talk about, where in the Bible, first of all, do we find the story of King Solomon?
Before I directly answer that question, I think at this point it is important that I repeat what I said in an earlier session. Following Joshua, the next several books of the Old Testament are part of the Deuteronomist theme, that the Israelites would be rewarded if they obeyed God's commandments and punished if they broke them. That's a theme that permeates the whole Old Testament. And this includes the books of Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, and 1st and 2nd Kings. The events described in these books covers the period from about 1200 BC to around 586 BC, a period of little over 600 years. And the biggest problems throughout all this period were that the 12 tribes continually slipped into idolatry and offered sacrifices in places not approved by God. That is, they offered sacrifices on numerous high places and in groves of trees, as did their pagan neighbors. Now, to answer your question specifically, the story of King Solomon is told in the book of 1 Kings, 1 Kings. We also get another perspective of him from the book of 1 Chronicles. 1 Kings begins with Solomon's succession to his father's throne and David's death. And to summarize the book before we actually get into some of the details, God grants Solomon great wisdom and riches, and his reputation and power grow rapidly. Then he builds the temple to hold the Ark of the Covenant, and a beautiful palace for himself, and another one for his Egyptian wife, the Pharaoh's daughter. He had the Ark brought into the new temple and dedicated the building to God. Then he prays for all of Israel. The book describes how his blessings increased and his fame spread. However, as he grew older, his wisdom began to fade as he became more and more foolish, less and less wise and more foolish. And as we shall see, because of this, he displeased God for several reasons, and he was punished, certainly after he died. The book ends as his son Rehoboam continues in his father's ways, and the northern tribes rebel and split off from his kingdom, creating the separate kingdom of Israel. That really was the punishment, this great kingdom that he had set up, that he had inherited from his father and even extended it even greater than that. This falls apart. The great prophet Elijah emerges at the very end of 1 Kings. And Rehoboam, the remaining kingdom was called Judah, and the kingdom of the northern tribes that split off from the empire was called Israel. So the area around Jerusalem was now called Judah, and the area, which would be basically Samaria and Galilee, then it became Israel, the kingdom of Israel.
So we've got the northern tribes now, 10 tribes in the north, and Judah and maybe parts of or all of Benjamin in the south?
Just part of it, yes.
Okay.
And well, the book of 2 Kings continues the story of the rise and fall of the kingdoms of Judah and Israel. So that's sort of an outline of
sure.
First Kings, and then what we'll do in the next session, we'll actually start going into the details of Solomon's reign.
Okay, well, I think it was nice you put in there again that if the Jewish people kept the commandments, they were blessed. If they didn't, they got into destruction and problems and all sorts of self-defeating activity. So it's the story that still runs like a golden theme through the Old and New Testament. Obey God and be blessed, and disobey God and get into all sorts of personal problems, difficulties, and self-destruction.
And of course, that's a story that permeates and is a thread through all of history as far as that is concerned, right down including our own nation, one of the most blessed people in the world, at least materially.
Ron, I want to thank you. Our time has run out on us. Our guest has been Ron Eldred, who is the teacher at John Paul II Catholic High of religion and history. And we say to our radio audience, may God bless you all, always and in all ways.